From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross has the day off. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with actress Sally Kirkland. She received her training at the Actors Studio with fellow students Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, and is now starring in the new movie, Anna. Also today, I speak with musician Ry Cooder. He's just released his 11th solo album. His compositions and distinctive slide guitar playing have also graced many motion picture soundtracks. Playwright Adrienne Kennedy reveals a moment of truth in her career, and critic at large Laurie Stone discusses the off-the-wall humor and magic of Penn and Teller. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is actress Sally Kirkland, who is now starring in the film Anna. In her teens, Kirkland was a fashion model. In her 20s, she acted in Andy Warhol's first film and worked with Joe Papp as well as the La Mama Theater Troupe. Sally Kirkland has been a member of the Actors Studio since the early 60s, studying with Lee Strasberg and working with Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and her godmother, Shelley Winters. She has appeared in over 35 television shows and more than 25 movies, sharing the screen with Robert Redford in The Sting and Barbara Streisand in The Way We Were. Her new movie, Anna, is the story of an aging Czech film star who has been exiled to New York and can only find work as an understudy in a terrible off-off-Broadway play. Christina, a young fan of hers, arrives from Czechoslovakia and manages to find the success that has eluded Anna in America. Sally Kirkland's performance as Anna has been called haunting, inspired, shattering, and worthy of an Oscar nomination. When she spoke to me at the NPR studio in New York, I asked her if she knew this role would be powerful when she read the script.
Yes. Let's see, I've been acting, since the 60s, early 60s, middle 60s, and you might say I've read at this point 800 scripts, and I would definitely say this is the best woman's role I've ever read. My favorite actress, if I had one, I suppose, who's alive, would be Vanessa Redgrave. And I loved what she did in Isadora. And when I saw her play Isadora Duncan, you know, the dancer, I thought, now that's the kind of role I need. Somebody incredibly theatrical, somebody tragic and comedic and eccentric and absolutely in love with men, but somewhat a victim of, I hate that word victim, but constantly giving the power away to men in such a way that it, you know, can possibly not be live happily ever after, which, you know, I'm working on, but I still haven't found it. So I love to play roles where I get to do on screen what happens in real life. I think it's the greatest role, not only written for me, if in fact I can fantasize that in the stars it was written for me, but for any actress I know. I'm happy to report that the great actresses that I admire all read this and were interested. You know, Vanessa Redgrave was interested. Lee Ullman was interested. The people in New York who not only were interested but tested a lot were Lee Grant, Shirley Knight, and Sandy Dennis. And, interest from Shelley Winters and Rita Gam and Uta Hagen. And, I think that the reason why great, particularly stage actresses, were interested in this role is that it is about a great actress, and therefore you get to run the gamut from A to Z in what only an actress could do, whereas so many other films are about just ordinary people, and so the emotions stay sometimes within a certain structure, unless it's an historical thing where, you know, somebody dies tragically or whatnot.
How did you get past all of those actresses that were up for this role and get the role for yourself?
I would say deep prayer and contemplation, 12 hours a day. No, I'm kidding. I talk to God a lot. I learned a Polish accent first and then Czech. I mean, for your listeners, I suppose I could start talking like this and say my name is Anna Rokova and I work on this accent starting in May straight up until I signed the contract in, second week August, and we start rehearsals. We start shooting September 1st. I did not stop talking like this until the second week in October. So from May until August, even when I didn't have the part, I talked like this because I assumed that I did have the part. I believe in, I'm going to be American again, I believe in visualizations and affirmations, and whatever it is you want in life, you write it down 100 times a day. You say, okay, these are my goals for the next 3 months, and these are my steps in getting my goals. You make what I call mind maps, where, you know, I put Anna in the center of a circle with trees, branches coming off it with all the different ways I would get it. One included changing my look. I found out from my kind of adopted godmother, Shelley Winters, that there's a woman who has tapes in the Bronx, and she uses them for facelift tapes, but I use them to pull my face out so I would look more Slavic, more Czech.
So you stick them on your face and pull the skin up.
Yeah, I pulled my whole face out so I had wider cheekbones, and then I had a beautician slant my eyes. And then I had my mouth changed because at that point the word was I was going to be Paulina Poroskova's mother. Yurik Bugajevich, the director, he tells me or told me later on that this was not true, but the rumor I heard from the casting director was that he thought I was the best actress but that my look wasn't Czech enough. In fact, he had offered it to a Czech actress who had turned it down, thank God. there I was, taping my face up, working around the clock with my back elevator man, who was a Czech director in Prague, whose wife was a Russian spy and turned him in. He spent 8 years in prison. And he was playing Anna for me, and I'm taping him. And then I'm hanging out with Zenka from the Czech Travel Bureau, and she happens to be 5'9" like me and blue-eyed blonde. And she kept saying, I don't believe it. You sound just like me. This is very scary. And I said, gut. And so that's how I got the accent. So it was a real challenge to become Eastern European and have the Eastern Europeans want to own me. And the neat thing about that was at the Montreal Film Festival, I would be standing outside the screening room afterwards, kind of waiting to see the response, and these women would come out and start speaking nonstop Czech to me, you know, because there is a very Eastern European community in Montreal. So clearly they did want to own me to the point where I had to say, I'm sorry, I don't understand a word you're saying. No.
My guest is Sally Kirkland, who's starring in the movie Anna. Do you find it ironic at all that given the body of work that you've done throughout your career, you're in your 40s now, that you had to go outside the United States to get a role that everyone is now noticing, even though you have been working consistently ever since you started?
Well, Leanne, I only admit to 39. but I will admit to working since the 60s. Let's see. Yeah, it's pretty ironic. I've done 26 movies and I think somewhere between 150 and 200 plays, be it stock, regional theater, off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway, off-off-off-off-Broadway, or Los Angeles theater, and 40 guest spots on television. And yet, I noticed when this first came out that people were kind of saying, well, who is she? Where's she been? And if you were in the know, then you would know that I had, in fact, starred in all of Terrence McNally's plays in the 60s off-Broadway and been the lead actress for Tom O'Horgan and this and that. But they had skipped the 15 years in L.A. in between, and the L.A. people were shocked to know that I had been a, quote, stage star in the 60s in New York. So it's almost like L.A. and New York are two different countries as far as I can see. So it's very funny to be an overnight success, yes, after all these years, but I'll take it however I can get it. You know, I hope that that it's an inspiration to people my age to see that, you know, you don't have to, in order to be an actress of the seriousness of, let's say, Meryl Streep, Glenn Close, Kathleen Turner, etc., you don't have to be 20-something or even 30. This comes a little close to what Jerry Page did in Sweet Bird of Youth, and suddenly everyone was talking about Sweet Bird of Youth and her collaboration with Tennessee Williams, and of course we all know she never stopped working after that. I think it's unusual for someone to be called a leading lady at my age as opposed to a character actress. And so I feel grateful. I feel a little bit like a kid at Christmas that's been given the most amount of toys that were ever possible. The way the media has taken to the film Anna and the interest in my own life and how, as you asked me, how I came to get this marvelous, miraculous part has touched me, really. So I can only hope and assume that there's a lot of humanity in the film and that it reaches people's souls, and that's why this is happening.
You had mentioned Shelley Winters earlier. She was a member of
Actors Studio.
She still is.
She is your godmother. You actually got involved with the Actors Studio. It seemed almost at the beginning, the golden age of the Actors Studio, with people like Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. What attracted you to that particular method of acting, which is actually called method acting, as opposed to, say, other forms of training that you might
Marlon Brando.
Did he?
Yes. I was 17 and a debutante coming out at the Waldorf Astoria, and my father was mainline Philadelphia and all of this, and something in me just thought, I don't want a life of the social register. I want to be an artiste, you know, and I want to be bohemian, and I want to be Marlon Brando. I wanted to be Marlon Brando. So I had my first interview with Lee Strasberg, and he said, who's your favorite actor? And I said, Marlon Brando. And Kim Stanley, I had just seen her on stage on Broadway, and the tears were streaming down my face as I walked out of the theater and right smack into a taxi cab. And I say that because she took me to such a faraway place that I didn't know where I was, what street I was in, what country I was in. And I thought, whatever that woman is doing, I want to be able to do. And I found out with some research that it was called method acting. And method acting, what is method acting? Method acting is truth. It's using everything that you know in your life experience or imagination to come from your gut, from your heart, from your soul, with absolutely no faking, no indicating. Now, the British are famous for faking it brilliantly to the point where we believe it sometimes. But the New York or the American method actors, they don't even know how to fake. And so the reason why I think, and by the way, I don't want to put down the British at all. I should deflect that statement because I think Olivier and Gielgud are geniuses. And I studied their records for 4 years when I was a young actress, imitating them so that I could do the classics as well as kitchen sink drama. But there's something about Brando and Dean and, you know, Maureen Stapleton and Kim Stanley and Jerry Page. And those women really impressed me. And so I went on their path. And I'm happy to say that the only person Bobby De Niro ever acted with at the Actors Studio was, in fact, me. He liked me as a sparring partner, and so we did many, many, many plays. I think the only other actress he acted with there was Diane Ladd.
Did he help you with this role at all?
Yes, he did. You've done good homework on me. I ran into Al Pacino on the street on 88th and Madison 3 days before I was going to perform 4 scenes of Anna at the Actors Studio. And I said, he says, oh, guess what, Sally? You've been asking me to moderate for years. I'm finally moderating, and I hear you're the one that's on stage. So I said, great, help me with my Eastern European accent. And he says, well, I don't know too much about Eastern European accents, but I'll tell you if it feels organic. So he came, and then I called Shelley and I called De Niro, and they all showed up to help because they have been very supportive to me over the years and very family. And truly, they've wanted me to make it. Bobby, in fact, has had me test for something like 8 of his films for his leading ladies. But if you know Bobby, he always concedes to the director. He lets the director make the final casting choice. So, unfortunately, it always got down to me and that other person. But here I was, you know, clearly very close to a lead role, and he really did want to see me get it. And so all three of them gave me notes and critiques. And basically, the main thing they said was, You have the accent, but you don't believe you have it. So at this point, you have to relax and just concern yourself with her history, with the Russian invasion, and with her relationship with the girl, etc. And forget about the accent, because it's there. And only then, when you forget about it, will it become organic. And that was the best advice they could have given me, because 3 days later, when I went in, I was believing that I was, in fact, Czech.
Well, Robert De Niro has a reputation for going the distance for whatever character that he portrays. He'll gain 50 pounds.
Yeah, he inspired me to gain weight for this role. I'm actually,
so you did.
Yeah, I was 140 in the film, and I'm 125 as you look at me now.
You're also younger in person than you are.
Thank you,
film.
Leanne.
Well, the first shot we see of you is, first we see your legs, which are in terrific shape, and then we see your face, and you're on the phone, and you've just been awakened early in the morning, and you're late for an audition, and the wrinkles are there.
Did you say it? I look terrible.
You looked awful.
Well, you want to hear how I got there?
Go ahead.
It's a funny story. I found out when all of the scenes were being shot where I had to look terrible. And I called up Bobby De Niro and I said, what did you do for Raging Bull? And he said, I ate a lot of ice cream. And so I proceeded to eat ice cream around the clock and cheese and dairy, which tends to bloat your face. And then that particular scene you mentioned, the opening scene, I once heard a funny story. Bobby Bukowski, the cameraman, went to a screening of Anna, and he was with a girl he was trying to impress, and at that point it hadn't been reviewed. And the opening scene comes out, and she says, I have to look at this bitch for the next hour and a half. You know, I was horrified to hear this, but I know what she means. I mean, it's kind of like, oh, my this is the star of the movie. I mean, I look like a truck ran over me. But the point is that Bobby got me on Derry. And so whenever I knew I had to look terrible, that scene, the scene where Daniel breaks up with me at the end, you know, that whole end of the film, I would eat Derry around the clock. And sure enough, I would get double chins, cellulite on my arms and all of that. The other thing that happened was that the scene where I get hit in the face, I asked them to really hit me in the face. Now, I know that sounds masochistic, but method actors are known for their, you know, like you said, taking it to the extremes. Well, I had been hit in the face for 3 hours the day before to get that scene in the rain where I have my, quote, nervous breakdown. And so what you saw at the opening of the film was Sally Kirkland having just been walloped for 3 hours the day before, combined with the dairy products. Oh, I'm happy to say I'm now wearing a size 6, and my face is thinned down, and I've had 4 film offers, one of which is 35 years old and is supposed to be beautiful. So I get a chance now to go to the other spectrum and show the film audiences that, in fact, this was an acting job, that that's not really me in that sense.
My guest is Sally Kirkland. She is starring in the current movie, Anna, and I'd like to talk to you a lot more about these, the things that you draw on, the things that you did draw on for this particular role. In just a moment, we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Sally Kirkland. She is in the new movie, Anna. In fact, she stars in the new movie, Anna. And you had mentioned earlier about how this movie is, there are autobiographical echoes in this particular movie, the story of Anna as parallels the story of Sally Kirkland. But there's an irony there. There's a scene at the beginning where you are actually auditioning for this, what looks to be terrible, off-Broadway show. And the director says, I want a personal moment from your sexual past, and you say to him, I can't do personal moments. I can only take direction.
Give me a script. I give you a script. Right. I do not want to talk about my personal life.
And he tells you, hop on one foot, yell, and recite Humpty Dumpty. That's the total opposite of what method acting
it would
is
seem
all
to
about.
Be. But that doesn't mean that method actors go around talking about their sex life. Don't misunderstand me. What method actors do is they use something called emotional recall. Actually, the emotional recall for that scene for me is that since I've been acting since the, certainly middle 60s, I can clearly say that at this point I've done 1,000 auditions in one way or another. And you can imagine how many times I've been asked to do ludicrous things. One time I was auditioning for Jerome Robbins for a musical, and I actually fell into the orchestra pit, just like that actress does. You know, I was in my bravado and my courage to sing and dance. I think I leapt, and I went right smack in the orchestra pit. So those things really happen to actors. Another time I was auditioning for a Broadway play, and I was so scared that I was vomiting off stage, and they kept calling my name, and I couldn't get out there because I was too busy. So, you know, it's like, the audition process is humiliating. It's absolutely frightening. It's like, you know, unlike a pianist who plays a piano or a painter who paints a canvas, you paint your emotions. And when they say, well, we don't like you because you're too old, which is what these guys were saying, or the one guy was saying, you know, you feel horrified. You feel, what should I do, shoot myself because I'm not 22? You know. So in that audition, I finally got to vent my sarcasm and my rage at everybody who has ever auditioned me in my entire life and asked me to do something ludicrous or made me feel like I'm not, you know, good enough. And so when he says, stand on one foot and do a nursery rhyme and yell, I was yelling at everybody that ever asked me. That was an emotional recall. And then when he says, then he suddenly says, do it as a nursery rhyme and sing it. Well, you know, I like to think I can sing, but I didn't know he was going to do that. Yurik surprised me. That was an improv moment. So I started crying because I couldn't sing. I don't know if you're understanding all this, but I'm a very visceral person. If someone asks me something and I can do it, then I really do it. And if someone asks me something and I feel vulnerable because it's not my expertise, then usually the tears will well up very quickly. You said a very important thing. How much of this was Sally Kirkland emotional recall? I'm not proud of the fact that I've had 2 divorces and that, you know, I've been in love with somebody for the past year who, you know, may or may not be ready, you know, to be as serious as I am. And so my favorite subject in the whole world is men and women in 1988 and relationships and making them work. And so when I go to the party to see my ex-husband and I get all dolled up and you can see the ecstasy and the bliss and the fantasy of what it's going to be like. And
you also put the tapes on your cheeks to make yourself look
younger. I put the tapes on my cheeks, right. And then when he rejects me and the tears well up like in, what, 5 seconds? That's an emotional recall of 20 years of me and men.
Could I ask you about a little less dramatic scene? I'm wondering what emotional recall you were using when you did... It wasn't a love scene, but the tone of it was like a love scene with a cockroach that was crawling across your
script. Leanne, you get a gold star. You can imagine how many interviews no one's ever thought to ask me that. It's a wonderful question. I have a scene with a cockroach, and because I believe, like Gandhi, that you don't kill insects and that there's life everywhere around you, including in the leaves on the trees. And so I talk to the leaves on the trees, and I talk to insects. And anyway, I am a vegetarian, this and that. And so here I am talking to this little cockroach, like it's my roommate, and I'm saying, you know, oh, I see you feel sick and tired like me, and you feel like you're falling over the edge. Well, I knew that in the script, the cockroach is supposed to walk to the edge of the script and fall over it. Well, you tell me how to train a cockroach to do that. We went through about 10 cockroaches, and they had to freeze them and put them in the bottle, hoping that when they would be unfrozen, they would move a little bit, just enough so that I would have a minute to talk to them before that they would get activated enough to run away from me. So that cockroach you saw, sweet cockroach that it was about the 15th one we went through before we could unfreeze them and get them to, and I don't think any of them died, I'm happy to say, but they all wanted to run around in circles. And so that was a pretty funny scene. I love that scene. I absolutely love that scene. A lot of people, I've seen screenings where people gasp because you don't know that the cockroach is moving, and then suddenly you see the cockroach crawling up my finger, and you think, this woman must be crazy. She's gotten to that point in her life where she doesn't have a man, so she's having a relationship with a cockroach. You know? But it's one of my favorite moments. My other favorite moment is when I am at the birthday party scene, and I'm clearly getting the picture that my boyfriend is going to go off with my protege, you know, the young actress. And so I decide to get a little drunk. And in my process of getting a little drunk, I stuff cake in my face and I start to laugh hysterically for no reason at all, just to be obnoxious. Well, we went through that scene for 3 hours and I ate, I believe, somewhere between 15 and 22 pieces of cake in order to get that scene. Mm. That scene, to me, was the funniest improv moment in the whole film because I didn't know myself how I was going to react to 22 pieces of cake. But my face started turning purple and red. I started crying and laughing at the same time.
At a totally inappropriate moment.
It's called obnoxious.
Obnoxious. You also have to go through a very powerful nervous breakdown. The character Anna goes on stage and begins to scream at the audience. And she's breaking down completely. And if indeed, as a method actress, you are drawing on this emotional memory, this emotional recall, whether it be from your own life or someone that you've observed, isn't that dangerous? How do you let go of a character at the end of shooting a movie or at night after doing a performance when you have involved every bit of your emotion in portraying it?
Well, I know this is going to sound really dramatic, okay?
Okay.
But I had a clinical death experience once in my life. And since then, I am very grateful to be alive. And
by clinical death, you
mean
you were
very... Well, my heart stopped, my lungs stopped, last rites were said. And I've had a couple of experiences at knife point and gun point just from being a New Yorker, you know. So for whatever reason, my life has been a dramatic one. So since I've been through what I call near-death experiences, I treat every day like it's extremely precious, like you and I sitting here talking now. This could be the last time I would ever see you. I hope it's not. But if it is, I want this to be as passionate and full a moment as you and I can have. And I like my whole life to be like, okay, in this day, how much joy can I give to someone just from being cheerful and up, and how much can I receive from them, from their open heart? And if the heart isn't open, hopefully I can cheer them up into an open heart. So when you ask that question, I can only say that was a very important moment for me, not crying for pain, but crying for the love of humanity. To me, when I cry, I don't cry out of pain. I cry out of, I'm going to show you me at my most naked. I'm going to show you my soul. I'm going to show you all of my joy and all of my pain and everything I've ever been through in my life. But for me, it's a gift from me to the audience. It's not, oh God, I'm going to go through something painful and get stuck in it. Quite the opposite. It's a release. It's almost like having a terrific baptism of tears and feeling cleansed after.
In Anna, you're working with one of the top fashion models. Paulina,
the top fashion model,
Paulina Pariskova. And you were a model once, you, along with Tuesday Weld and Carol Lindley. Did you compare notes at all about, like, what it's like now, what it was like then, you know?
Well, yes. I happen to love the camera. I remember I once heard that Garbo, her best lover in her life, was the camera. I understand what she means. I just have a spiritual experience when I'm in front of a camera. And I think Paulina does too. And we would compare notes about how the camera, the relationship to the camera, to stills and all of that, is a truly liberating, joyous experience. She, as you know, she's very outspoken about it, doesn't particularly love the whole thing of modeling all the time. She really wants this to be good for her so that she can have an acting career. I just want to say for your listening public that Paulina Pariskova is one of the most special people I've ever met in my life. The fact that she was a Czech at the Russian invasion, a little girl, and had to be smuggled out of the country, did not leave when her parents escaped the country, and it took 6 years before she could see her family. She obviously went through a lot as a child, and so she has a tremendous compassion inside her for all human beings who are going through whatever they're going through. And in many ways, because of Anna going through her pain, Paulina would constantly be mothering me throughout the film, because she would think that Sally was going through the pain, you know. And at one point, you know, my house, my legal residence is California, although now I'm totally bicoastal and living in New York currently. At the time, I did not have my sublet that I had had. And she said, oh, here, take my house, take my clothes, take this. And she was really trying to let me know that she was afraid that I was like Anna. I kept trying to tell her, no, don't worry about me. Sally Kirkland's fine. But there's an extremely maternal, beautiful inner beauty. I mean, here's a case of a woman who's the most beautiful woman in the world, and she has an inner beauty that transcends, I don't know, just extraordinary amounts of whatever I could imagine she'd be like. So for the Paulina fans out there, I really think you'd be amazed to go see her do her first film and show her soul a bit, you know. She did a lot of the writing, too, in the film.
Really?
Well, check.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, and everyone can go and see Sally Kirkland in the new movie, Anna. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk to us today.
Well, again, it's my pleasure, and thank you, and thank your listeners.
My guest has been Sally Kirkland. She's now starring in the film Anna. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is back on the next edition of Fresh Air, and she'll speak with film director John Sayles. His latest film, Matewan, tells the story of a West Virginia coal miner's strike. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is off today. Coming up, musician Ry Cooter talks about his search for the songs which appear on his latest album, Get Rhythm. Also, playwright Adrian Kennedy talks about growing up black and middle class in Cleveland and how that's affected her writing. And critic at large Laurie Stone looks at magicians Penn and Teller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm in Washington. Secretary of State George Shultz briefed NATO ministers on the verification provisions of the medium-range missile treaty signed this week by President Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev. The Allies quickly adopted the package, one of the last steps leading to the destruction of more than 2,600 nuclear weapons. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has details.
The allies of both superpowers have now approved the verification provisions in the new INF treaty, which will mean on-site inspections at missile bases in their countries for the next 13 years. The Warsaw Pact approval involves both East Germany and Czechoslovakia, which have Soviet missiles. American inspectors will be able to look at those Soviet bases once the treaty has been ratified and takes effect. For NATO, Soviet on-site inspections will take place in West Germany, Great Britain, Italy, Belgium, and the Netherlands, where, all except the Netherlands, U.S. missiles are already based. Both NATO and the Warsaw Pact have thus endorsed the new treaty, although the Eastern Bloc has warned NATO against bringing in new nuclear weapons to compensate for those being eliminated. And although Eastern European diplomats had suggested Soviet leader Gorbachev might make some new negotiating proposal while in East Berlin, that did not occur today. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
President Reagan today received high marks from congressional leaders for his summit meeting with Gorbachev. Senate Republican leader Robert Dole described today's White House briefing as sort of a love feast. Dole and others predicted the INF treaty will be ratified by the Senate. But at least one lawmaker sounded a word of caution, Democratic Representative Les Aspin.
Be careful. It may be a new era in U.S.-Soviet relations, but we have gone through this before and we've been disappointed. And the problem is when we get disappointed, the pendulum swings violently in the other direction, and then everybody goes violently anti-Soviet.
Aspin is chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Pennzoil and a committee representing Texaco shareholders have agreed on a $3 billion settlement proposal aimed at resolving the legal battle between the two oil companies. The settlement would be included in a reorganization plan for Texaco that could be filed in U.S. bankruptcy court next week. But the deal must be approved by a committee representing Texaco's creditors and two-thirds of Texaco's shareholders. The Commerce Department reports retail sales rose a modest 0.2% last month, reflecting a decline in consumer demand for cars, furniture, and home furnishings. Some economists, such as Michael Evans, believe the slight increase in retail sales is the first sign of consumer fallout from the plunge in stock prices in October.
Well, retail sales figures were extremely significant. Not only was there virtually no increase in the November numbers, but the October numbers were substantially revised down. Now, when the October numbers are revised down, that means that there was evidently a tremendous drop-off in sales in the last 10 days of October, precisely the period after the stock market crash. So this is by far the most important piece of evidence we have that consumers really did cut back on their spending after Black Monday.
Other economists were heartened that the retail sales figures weren't worse. Retail establishments sold nearly $126 billion worth of goods last month. Earlier estimates had been that the figure would be lower. Robert Dederich, who's chief economist of Northern Trust Company in Chicago, said Americans appear to have zipped up their pocketbooks some, but not totally. Overall, prices at the wholesale level showed no significant change last month, according to the latest statistics from the government. However, vegetable prices skyrocketed. The wholesale price of lettuce soared more than 95% last month. On Wall Street, stock prices closed the day and the week slightly higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 11 points to 1,867. Trading was fairly active, 150 million shares. Advancing stocks outnumbered decliners by 4-3. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Playwright Adrian Kennedy joins us today with a work in progress. Kennedy began writing seriously in college, but she says she's really been writing since she was a child in Cleveland. She recently published a memoir called People Who Led to My Plays, about people, books, and movies that influenced her development as a playwright. That book ends in 1961, when she's 29. She's returning home to New York after spending a year with her husband in Rome and Africa. And in her suitcase, she has a play she's written, Funny House of a Negro. It's about a young black woman named Sarah who is confused about her identity and in the end commits suicide. In 1962, Adrienne Kennedy joined Edward Albee's playwriting workshop at the Circle in the Square, where she struggled with her play and her craft. It was, she says, a turning point.
New York, 1962, Circle in the Square, Edward Albee. He was wearing a tweed suit and seemed shy and frightened. In a muted voice, he read from his notes about what our playwriting class was to consist of. Each person was required to have a play done in workshop. The class was upstairs over the theater at Circle in the Square on Bleecker Street. Outside, the wind blew the Circle in the Square sign, which still hangs there today. He invited the class to a rehearsal of The Sandbox at the Cherry Lane. During the rehearsal, he went up on stage and spoke quietly to the actors. There was a hole in his sweater. It gave him the air of a struggling writer. Michael Kahn was the Circle's brilliant young director. It was his job to cast the workshop productions. My play was to be in April. Michael had mentioned the possible casting of Diana Sands, Yaphet Kotto, and others. But during the winter, I became frightened. My play seemed far too revealing. I sat in the bedroom of our Park West Village apartment and carefully edited out the word nigger from Funny House of a Negro, the word that Sarah, the main character, used to define her own self-hatred. Before the next class, I took the new edited script up to the office above the Circle and asked for my original script back. I thought it was settled. When it was time for me to have my meeting with Michael Kahn about my workshop production, I discovered that he somehow had copies of my original script and had not received my edited one. I said I would drop out of the class if they used my original script. "Don't worry," he said. "I'll tell Edward Albee you want the new version done." At the next class, I told Albee I wanted the edited version of Funny House done, unaware that this pattern I had clung to for a decade of editing out the darkness and violence in my work, in this case Sarah's self-hatred, had very often destroyed it. I arrived at what I thought would possibly be my last class. Edward Albee was in the theater alone. "Mr. Albee," I said, "I've decided to drop the class." He stared straight into my face. "Oh," he said, it's your decision, but don't you want to see your play performed? It is a chance to see your characters on the stage." "My play is too revealing," I said. "I'm embarrassed to have it done. The other plays so far are not so revealing." He stuck his hands into his pockets, came closer to me, and stared. His gaze was hypnotic. "Do you see that stage?" he said, glancing at the Circle's theater in the round. "Yes." "Well, do you know what a playwright is? A playwright is someone who lets his guts out on the stage, and that's what you've done in this play." I didn't know what to say. That was the whole point. I didn't want my guts let out in front of the whole class. I stepped back and started toward the door. "It's your decision," he said. I remained in the class, and for the first time, the anguish I was used to carefully blotting out in the second and third drafts of my work was revealed. First to my director, then to the actors Diana Sands, Yaphet Kotto, Andre Gregory, Lynn Hamilton, and Fran Bennett, and finally to the other writers in the workshop. I still wasn't sure I had done the right thing. The studio. When we performed the play at the Circle in April, it was so controversial that Michael, who was a member of Actors Studio, decided to do it as his project at the studio the following week. While we rehearsed Funny House, as everyone now called it, Michael told me that several theater people would be there to see it. Rip Torn, Geraldine Page, Harold Klorman. Although Michael was many years younger than I was, he was experienced in the theater and attempted to be reassuring. The idea of doing a play that these theater people were coming to see and were going to comment on afterwards made me sick. During one of the last rehearsals, I felt so frightened that I ran outside and sat on the steps. I asked Michael, why were people suddenly calling me Miss Kennedy? He explained it was what theater people did. I had heard that after the play, it was the practice of the unit members to demolish the playwright. Although I was totally demolished, with a final suggestion that the play might have a deep charm and might be important, I was asked to join the unit. The next week, as I was standing in the lobby of the Circle to go to our last class, Albee came in and stopped and asked me would I be going to the Actor's Studio every Tuesday. I expressed uncertainty. Tennessee Williams sometimes goes, he said, and turned and walked away. I went for a while. Miss Kennedy. People now started to refer to me as a playwright. Even after years of attending playwriting workshops, I still wondered, how could I be a playwright? Shakespeare was a playwright. Miller, Williams, Langston Hughes, Ionesco. A playwright was Sartre, standing in a raincoat in a street in Paris.
Adrienne Kennedy is now writing her second memoir about her early career in the theater. In 1964, Funny House of a Negro won an Obie Award and was subsequently translated into French, Danish, and German. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Ry Cooder. He's earned a reputation for the kind of slide guitar playing that could make a lizard crawl down from a wall and make a young girl forget her upbringing. He got his first guitar when he was 4. Growing up in Santa Monica, California, he would listen to every radio station and try to play all the different musical styles, jazz, honky-tonk, Tex-Mex, rock and roll, rhythm and blues. This musical exploration would continue throughout his career. Ry Cooder has composed 9 film scores, including Paris, Texas, and has released 11 solo albums. The latest is called Get Rhythm. On the back of the album cover, he thanks one of his guides to the world of obscure music, Barry Hanson, also known as Dr. Demento.
I've known Barry for, Lord, let's see, maybe since I was 14 or 15. I mean, we go way back as friends. So I always thank him because when the course of making these records, I need to turn to him sometimes and say, you know, help me out. I've heard of a song. For instance, Nick Lowe said, go listen to this 13-question method. I thought I'd heard everything of Chuck's, you know. Chuck Berry, I mean to say.
Yes, Chuck Berry, who did write this song.
He wrote the song, yeah.
Right, 13-question method. Yeah. And it's not at all what you expect from Chuck Berry, because you're used to him being loud. But here, the song is it's just a quiet.
Well, of course, his version of it's different. He did a kind of a rumba, nightclub, bongo, Desi Arnaz trip on it. But his songs are food for thought. You know, they contain a lot of different ideas other than what's overtly there, I think. So I listened to it, and I thought, well, I'm going to file that away in my mind, because you could sing that song any kind of way you want to. It could sound uptown or downtown or whatever. And those kind of flexible songs will come in handy one of these days, I figure.
Now the 13-question method is the one to you. Listen to me. 13-question method is the one to you. I'm saying that the 13-question method is the one you got to use. Wanna have some fun, cause the 13-question method is the one to use. Question number one, you wanna have fun? Mm-hmm.
number two, what to do? Let's see. Question number three, wanna go out and eat burger with me? God almighty, well, the 13th question, method is the one to you.
You are one of the few people who take songs, take tunes from bygone eras, for lack of a better word, and you do them in such a way that they are moved into the present. You don't give us a quote-unquote museum-faithful rendition of a song. You add something to it. You arrange it differently. Do you hear those different arrangements when you're listening to an old tune like this?
Well, you see, the music's not in a museum, I don't think. When it gets to the museum stage, it's over, it's dead, I'm afraid. But I see the music, it's all out there, whether it's a guy 20 years ago or 50 years ago or yesterday. If it's a good song, it has a life outside of a time frame.
On this album, you seem to be exploring a new era of music, the 50s, the 60s. You do a remake of All Shook Up. Are you finding a new gold mine of music in that particular era now?
Oh, no. You really must understand this is all accidental. We were sitting in the studio, and me and the rhythm section, and I say to the cats, I say, All Shook Up. Everybody remembers All Shook Up. I'm going to sing it. Go with me. And there was, at the end of that take, which wasn't so much a take, you know, but just a kind of a stab at something, we had a version of All Shook Up. And that's a good song. I mean, it's actually a great song. Itching Like a Man on a Fuzzy Tree has got to be one of the primary lyrics of the modern era.
Like a man on a fuzzy tree. Your friends say you're mad, but why is a bug in the world? I'm all shook up.
Did this creative process, this process you used on the new album, Get Rhythm, was it different from the process you would have used on some of your earlier albums?
No, this process seems to always be the same. You know, I look at these records as signposts along the way, like an old-time, what they used to call them, those shaving ads on the, as you went
Burma
along.
Burma shave signs, yeah.
That's what they are. And you keep going on down the road, the musical road, trying to get better at it.
There's also something to be said for selling art in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Is the marketplace more receptive to your art right now?
Well, I'm going to have to wait and see, aren't I? I mean, the thing just came out. I figure it is, because I figure people have, on the one hand, been opened up as so much stuff that everything can exist side by side now. You can have Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and you can have Los Lobos doing La Bamba, and you can have some haircut band over here and you two doing this Irish folk rock that they do, and it's all fine, it's all good. And I also think that all this movie work I did created some kind of hidden visual clues to what I was up to, and people absorb what they see on the big screen a lot faster than they do what's on the disc.
You've called movies the last refuge of the abstract composer.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they don't look to you to write a bunch of four-minute songs. I mean, they do have four-minute songs in some movies, but they want composition. They want mood and texture and hidden, you know, just tonality and feeling. And you can stop worrying about form so much and get into your own emotion for the thing, the feeling of it. And that's been a great, you know, a liberating kind of thing for me.
What were you looking for when you did Paris, Texas? What emotion, what visual clues were given to you as a detective?
Well, first of all, the sight of Harry Dean Stanton, a torn up looking guy with a red hat in the middle of the desert with a water bottle, is a clue. It's an absolute statement. So, what does that sound like? Well, you just go with him as he walks through the landscape, in the town, in the country, in the restaurant, in the motel. You follow him and play it with him. You know, it's a shot in the dark, but it is always a detective problem, but it's great. When it works, it's thrilling, you know, it's terrific, I must say.
And Paris, Texas does work.
Oh, it works, yeah.
Are you going to have to tour with this particular album with your band?
Well, I want to. It's a great band. There's about 11 of us all together. Four singers, Flaco Jimenez on accordion, the great Steve Douglas on sax, and so forth. And it's a fabulous experience for me, and the musicians love to play the music. It's free, improvised, primitive, postmodern, neo-primitive village music. Kind of a master village orchestra we are at this point, only we don't live in a village. But if we did, the imaginary village orchestra, I think, would sound the way we sound, I think it's fair to say.
Are you still playing guitar with the sawed-off neck of a sherry bottle?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a sound that I like to hear. It's a sound that people are interested in more and more. It's a pretty sound. And you can also use it to do snarly, horrible, scary things, you know, and that's nice, too, sometimes.
What do you do, go around to people's empty ash cans and pick up the old bottles?
Oh,
and
yeah, I mean, you know, I get my shopping cart out. No, I just go to the liquor store and buy a bottle that looks correct. I've figured it out finally that the sherry bottles are all heavier glass for some stylistic reason, I don't know, and have the longer necks, and I tape them off and take them to the auto glass store and then pour the booze into a bucket for the workers, and then they, before they drink it, I tell them, first, cut these necks off, you know, and then you can drink it and wash your hands later on. They don't like to do it because it makes their saws dull, but I pay them pretty good money, you know, $5 a shot, and they make me these things.
Ry Cooter, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Well, thank you.
Ry Cooter's new album, Get Rhythm, is on the Warner label. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the day's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program. Hello, Renee.
Hi, Leanne.
Well, now that the summit's over, what?
Well, we'll have post-summit stories for you tonight. Among them, how Russians are reacting in Moscow to the goings-on this week in Washington. Euphorically, our reporter informs us. How American business leaders are reacting to Mr. Gorbachev. They like him. Mr. Gorbachev wants to make it easier to do business deals between both countries, and he may be able to work out, some of that may be able to be worked out. Also, a look at Soviet money, what it means that the ruble is a soft currency. And we remember violinist Yasha Heifetz.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, has a review of the new act from Penn and Teller, currently appearing on Broadway. They're a new vaudevillian duo in which one guy speaks and the other doesn't.
Maybe you've seen Penn and Teller's unique comedy magic show on public television, or caught their complete act off-Broadway. Unlike Bill Irwin and other new vaudevillians, these two don't make you jump through high art hoops to get to the crowd-pleasing stuff. They've just moved to a small Broadway house, the Ritz Theater, and if you're coming to New York during the holidays, don't miss them. They've added one bit. Teller, the petite, nimble, silent partner, is in a tank of water. There's a slit at the top for his hand, which clutches the key to the tank's lock. He's prepared to hold his breath until Penn finds a card which an audience member has written his name on. Penn has shuffled it into a deck and, of course, can't find it, won't find it. The seconds tick away as Penn's megaphone mouth touts Houdini's breath-holding record, 5 minutes, 45 seconds. After a while, he bangs on Teller's tank. You broke the record. Teller's deadpan stare, part Buster Keaton, part Kubrick space baby, is visible through his diver's mask. After 6 minutes, Teller frantically waves the key. After 8 minutes, Penn tries the lock, discovering it won't open. He shrugs. Teller's body turns, lifeless. Penn taps the tank again. Brain dead. It's a trick. Teller stays in the tank for more than 11 minutes and doesn't die. The stunt is beautiful. Teller winds up with the missing card under his mask. Rather than being embarrassed by their love of freak shows and sleaze, Penn and Teller revel in it. Penn describes himself as the obnoxious one with the stupid haircut, and you can't argue. The head atop his tall, hulking body sports a braided rat tail behind and a flowing frizz mop in front. The hipness lacing his nonstop rap skates on corniness. One minute he calls himself and Teller two eccentric guys who've learned to do a few cool things. Another minute, before eating fire, he milks our sympathy, explaining that, each night, a teaspoon of poisonous fluid is also swallowed. But both tacks are calculated. Penn is the carny barker, luring the sadist in us to gawk at the seal boy and the two-headed fetus. He's also one of the freaks. The show lets us indulge our taste for gore and pain over the safety net of the performer's mastery. In one stunt, Teller is straitjacketed, then hoisted upside down above the stage. His head points at a bed of wooden spikes, and he'll crash unless he can escape before Penn finishes speed-reading Casey at the bat. In two other pieces, hands are fake pierced and gooey fake blood spurts. And in the evening's tour de force, Teller swallows 24 embroidery needles and 6 feet of thread. Then, from his gullet, extracts the same number of needles knotted on the thread. In some of the duo's most gleeful bits, they lead us behind the scenes of a trick. First, they do the famous cups and balls routine. Then they do the trick again, with plastic cups, explaining every feint and pass. But this is a trick, too, for their intention isn't to demystify their powers, but to make us marvel at them all the more. We do. Seeing the works of this trick is like glimpsing the gears and jewels of a precision watch. The skill of these men asks us to wonder about such devotion to craft, the hours spent developing card moves and shifting fire inside the mouth. Under their weird exteriors lurk true weirdos. Their compensation, aside from fame and fortune? During their show, they get to hold all the secrets. We are forever left out, but this is a meager price to pay for such satisfying gawking.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic. When Penn and Teller's Broadway run ends on February 28th, they're scheduled to begin shooting their first feature film, Penn and Teller Get Killed. Here's a look at our next show. On the next Fresh Air, Terry Gross will speak with J.J. Johnson, one of the pioneers of the modern jazz trombone. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new album by the World Saxophone Quartet, and television critic David Bianculli will review Jack Parr is Alive and Well, NBC's look back at the first host of The Tonight Show. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. The address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, PA, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of Philadelphia's business and cultural district.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.